From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thanks, everybody. Thank you. This week, Wait, Wait goes diva. Well, with Carl around, we do that every week. But this time, we mean it literally. We're going to revisit some of our recent interviews with some remarkable, interesting, opinionated women.
And many of them also swore like sailors, but we had to edit those bits out.
We begin with the amazing, very friendly, very energetic, and very southern chef and lifestyle guru, Paula Deen. We're so glad to have you. And your story is true. You weren't one of those ambitious women who started from the earliest age to go out and get rich and get famous.
No, honey, I just wanted to be a wife and a mama. I didn't get started, Peter, until I was 42.
Really?
I retired first.
Right.
And then came out of retirement to try to earn me a living.
Right, and then you opened your restaurant
I started a business called The Bag Lady.
And now, of course, you've got your cooking shows and the Food Network and your cookbooks. Now, you are known, you're famous, infamous in some circles for your recipes, including, and I just got a short list here, the cheesy ham banana casserole.
Yes.
Paula's fried butter balls. Bacon-wrapped, deep-fried macaroni and cheese.
Yeah, guilty.
Sure. But the one that everybody talks about is, of course, the ladies' brunch burger. It's a hamburger between two crispy cream donuts. With a fried egg on top.
Yes. And you would not believe how stinking good it is.
I believe it.
I believe it.
Listen, that kind of happened by accident. It just kind of unfolded.
Wait a minute. Stop. Tell me how that happened.
A kitchen collision.
No. I want to hear the story. What happened?
It was so good that Michael had just gotten in and gotten to sleep good because he's a harbor pilot, so he works crazy hours.
This is your husband?
Yes. I ran back in the bedroom and I said, Michael, you've got to taste this. But there's only one catch, Peter.
Yes.
It's only one serving per lifetime.
Really?
Yes.
You only get one.
Wait, Paula, this is Roxanne.
Hey, Roxanne.
Now, here's my question, all right? So you got a burger, all right? And do you say, oops, I'm out of buns. I think I'll use donuts.
Well, you know, those donuts were there.
Yeah,
and,
in the way that they often are.
The hamburger was there. Mm-hmm. So I said, what the heck are we using buns for when we got these luscious donuts?
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah, Paula, that, can I just want to interject here. Paula, this is Tom, and I really enjoy this kind of cooking, and I'm just wondering, when I have my heart attack, do you have anything in your recipe book for the recovery period?
You know, I actually do, Tom.
What is that?
Well, there's salads in there. And other good stuff in this newest cookbook. In this
can you name any
cookbook.
One other thing?
No.
Is that your famous fried salad?
Yeah. You've gone from cook to your cookbook author, TV show host. You've got in addition to your books and your restaurants in Savannah, you've got a line of furniture coming out.
Yes, it is so drop dead fabulous. And
is it covered in butter?
Yeah. How do you deep fry an ottoman?
Oh, it's easy, honey. You just dip it in egg first. Y'all are making me sound like a pervert.
No. I gotta tell you. If we are playing a game, you've won it, Paula, so don't you worry about that. But no, I have a serious question, and the serious question is this, is that there are other people who've achieved what you have and have become kind of a purveyors of lifestyles. There's Martha Stewart, in which everything is just so and perfect and artful and graceful. Mm-hmm. And then there's, you know, like William Sonoma, in which you're supposed to be a wealthy person in Napa. How would you describe the Paula Deen lifestyle? I mean, is there a way you can sum it up, your worldview, what you're selling?
I think in one word, Peter, if I had to choose one word, I would say comfort.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. We got a lot of nods from the audience.
I love the comfort food. When you walk into my house, I hope it says to you, oh, come in. I want people to feel like they're coming home.
So you're at home, Paula, at your home in Savannah, And I want you to do me a favor. I want you, if you can, to tell us what is in your refrigerator right now.
Oh, my goodness. My refrigerator is slap-kadab full. There's pumpkin cake on the counter. There's a caramelized apple cake on the counter. There's a standing rib roast that I had left over from the other night. Let's see. I'm coming in here to look. Let me see what all's in here. Oh, my gosh, so much chicken and lasagna and lots of sour cream and butter and mayonnaise. There's tons of mayonnaise in here. And, oh, there's a bowl of fruit.
How'd that get there?
I don't know. I must have got that from my grandson, Jack.
That's sure. Got to be the loneliest bowl of fruit in the Southland.
Oh, my goodness. Let me tell you. Go on. Let me tell y'all what the best thing in my refrigerator is. It's a chocolate brownie cobbler. It will knock your socks clean off and into the washer. It is fabulous. And listen.
What?
Michael, I just walked in here in the kitchen, and Michael's sitting down to eat. Guess what he's eating?
What is he eating?
Nutrisystem.
No. No.
Yes, he is.
What a blow.
Beefsteak. He has made a vow to lose 95 pounds by Christmas, and then he said he's going to write a book, How I Lost 95 Pounds and Married to Paula Deen.
Well, Paula Deen, we have invited you here to play a game we're calling...
It's colorless, flavorless, vaguely slimy, and yum-a-rific.
That's right, Paula Deen. We are going to ask you three questions about tofu.
Oh, yuck, I can't stand it.
We figured that would be the case. This, of course, is the Asian miracle food, the yin, if you will, to the fried Twinkies yang. And if you get two...
Tofu.
If you get two questions, two out of three right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice in the home answering machine. So, Carl, who is Chef Paula Deen playing for?
Paula's playing for Sandy Williams of Trenton, Missouri.
All right.
Okay.
Like every other important thing in life, tofu has a legendary origin. According to ancient Chinese lore, how did tofu come to be? Was it A, trying to fool enemies into thinking his army was larger than it was, an emperor decreed that soybeans be molded into large white fake soldiers? Was it B, a wise man tried to come up with an immortality elixir and instead came up with tofu? Or C, 100 pounds of soybeans were hidden from thieves down a well and when brought up had been transformed?
Oh, my goodness. I will take B. I will choose B.
That somebody was looking for an immortality elixir, the secret to eternal life, came up with tofu instead.
Yeah.
You're right. That's what happened.
You're kidding.
According to Chinese legend... His name is Liu An. He was the son of an emperor. He went up to the mountains to produce the secret to everlasting life. Instead, came back with tofu, which everybody thought was pretty good anyway.
Oh, my goodness.
That's really good.
I can't believe I got it right.
You did. You did, Paul. A good heart will lead you every time. Here is your next question. Over the years, tofu has been credited with various almost magical powers, some good, some bad, including which of these? A, if you eat nothing but tofu... It'll make your irises, that's the colored part of your eye, it'll make them milky white. B, tofu can make your sweat smell like fresh blueberries. Or C, it can make you gay.
C, it can make you gay.
It can, Paula, you're right. It can make you gay. In 2006, a writer named Jim Rutz, who was very exercised over this, tried to start a crusade against soy products. Because he noted that it had trace amounts of estrogen, the female hormone. Ipso facto, eating too much tofu can make you gay. Here, Paula, is your last question. Tofu is sometimes a source of controversy, as it was just recently, when what happened? A, prisoners at Angola State Prison in Louisiana sued successfully the warden, saying the replacement of their cheeseburgers with soy cheese tofu burgers was a violation of their rights. Was it B, a Colorado vegan was not allowed to have a custom license plate which read, I love tofu, because the DMV said it was obscene? Or C, students at a high school in Florida all refused to eat tofu because of a rumor that it was boneless, processed lizard meat?
Oh, my goodness. I would say A.
You're going to go for A. The prisoner successfully sued, yes, saying that making them eat tofu was a violation, yes, of their rights.
Yes.
No, actually, it was a license plate.
You are kidding.
I'm not. I'll explain why. Kelly Kaufman Lee, this is the name of the woman, she loves tofu. She wanted to tell other drivers that with a license plate that read, and I'll spell it out for you, ILVTOFU. And the Colorado DMV said the message might be misinterpreted. That's what happened.
Oh, my gosh.
Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy.
It's just nuts, but it happened. Carl, how did Paula Deen do on our show?
Well, enough, Peter. Paula, you had two correct answers, so you win for Sandy Williams.
Yay, Sandy.
Paula Deen is the host of Paula's Home Cooking and other programs in the Food Network. She's the author of numerous books. Her latest is the Deen Family Cookbook. It's out now. Paula Deen, what a joy to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Oh, Peter, it's been my pleasure.
It's been
Best
fun.
Best wishes and love to y'all.
Thank you, Paula. Take care.
Bye-bye, y'all too.
Bye-bye.
If love makes you give up steak and potatoes, rice, corn, chitlins and tomatoes. Love makes you give up all those things. I don't want love. If love makes you give up.
This week we are revisiting some of our favorite interviews with remarkable women. For example, Chicago's own Mavis Staples.
She became a legend first with her family gospel group, the Staples Singers, and then as a star of soul and R&B and hits like I'll Take You There.
And then she stole my heart. Here's Mavis Staples.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter.
Oh, Mavis, thank you so much. Can we say, on balance, it's a great time to be from Chicago? On balance?
Yeah. Chicago, you know, is the most beautiful city in the world to me.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Yes, it is. You know, Pops came to us one time and said, y'all know, they said, if we move to Los Angeles.
No, I'm just interrupting. This is Pop Staples, your father.
Pop Staples, yes.
Who led, of course, the great gospel group, the Staples.
Yes, Staples. He okay. did. You all know, the managers are saying if we move to Los Angeles, we stand a better chance of making it. You know, yeah. If you're already out there, you know, then you get a better chance of. And he asks us, do you all want to move to Los Angeles? And all of us in harmony said, no, Daddy. We didn't want to move.
So it's true, you started singing with your family when you were how old?
I was 8 years old.
You were 8 years old?
8 years old.
On the road performing?
No, we didn't start. We were at home on the floor, you know. When we were rehearsing, we started singing. My aunt lived with us. She came through one night and she said, y'all sound pretty good. I believe I want y'all to sing at my church. And we were happy. You know, that Sunday we were going to sing someplace other than on the living room floor. And went to Aunt Katie's church and we sang the very first song that Pops taught us. And that, you know, the people liked us so much they clapped us back.
All right.
And we had to sing that same song over and over. So, because it was the only one he had taught us all the way through.
But you have to tell us what that song is.
Oh, that song is, will the circle be unbroken
by and by, Lord,
by and by. Yeah. So after that, they clapped us back so much, Pops said, well, shucks, these people like us. We're going home and learn some more songs.
And
the rest is history.
Yeah. I don't know if anybody's ever pointed this out to you, but you have a rather distinctive voice. And did you always have that? Did you always?
I've always had. I used to have fights. Really? You know, kids at school. You sound like a boy. You sound like a. And the acapella teacher, I wanted to sing in the acapella choir. He would tell me always, Mavis, come out of the basement. You're with the boys. You're singing with the boys. You know, and Mr. Finch, I'm not a soprano. My voice. I would wake up, someone, when we started traveling, I called down for breakfast. The lady would say, yes, Mr. Staples. Yeah. So I just started to taking it.
Now, you said you were traveling, so after a while, your family began going out on the road, performing gospel music and other places, and that's an odd way for a young woman to grow up, isn't it?
No, well, being with your family is fun, but actually, we didn't start traveling until after we made this record for VJ Records called Uncloudy Day, and I was actually singing bass. you know. Wow. And people, we started getting letters from everywhere, and Pop says, well, these people want us to come out. We would drive. Yeah. And we'd get to these places, and this jockey say, this is little Mavis Staples, little girl singing this. People would actually bet that I was not a little girl. Yeah. There's got to be a man or a big fat lady.
But were you ever at home in school, or were you on the road all the time?
Oh, yes. I didn't miss any of my childhood.
Really?
I don't know. We would travel on the weekends. Pops would come to school and tell the teachers, give Mavis some homework. She won't be back on Monday. I would always get back to school on Tuesday.
So you were like a schoolgirl in the week, and on the weekends you were traveling a singing star. You were like the gospel Hannah Montana. I don't think that's... I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't know. I think Hannah Montana, she has a tutor, doesn't she?
I think she does. I'm not sure. I'm sorry. You didn't have that.
We couldn't afford a tutor.
So... there's so much to cover, and we don't have enough time. But in the '60s, you guys—I don't know how it first happened. You sang at a rally where Martin Luther King was speaking, or you met him through performing, right?
We met him. We happened to be in Montgomery, Alabama, on a Sunday, right. And that Sunday morning, we were singing that night. That Sunday morning, Pops called us to his room. He said, "Listen, y'all, this man Martin is here. He had been here on the radio. Yeah. Dr. King had a radio show, and Pop said he has a church here. I want to go to his 11 o'clock service. Do you all want to go?" We said, "Yes, sir, we want to go." We all went to Dr. King's church. We were ushered in. Someone let him know that we were in the service, and he acknowledged us, said, "I'm happy to have Pop Staples and his daughters here this morning, and we hope you enjoy the service." After the service, Dr. King stands at the door to shake the worshipers' hands as they file out. My sisters and I, we walked past, shook his hand, and when Pops got to him, he stood there and talked with him for a while. He finally came on. We get back to the hotel. He called us to his room again. He said, "Listen, y'all, I really like this man's message. I like his message, and I think that if he can preach it, we can sing it." Hmm. And that's when we started writing freedom songs. "Why Am I Treated So Bad" was his favorite. And we would be going to a meeting. Dr. King would tell Pops, "Now, Stape, you're going to sing my song tonight, right?" Mm. And Pop said, "Oh, yeah, Doctor, we're going to sing your song." We would sing before he would speak, and that would be "Why Am I Treated So Bad."
Huh. So you work with everybody in music. In fact, you work with Bob Dylan, we understand.
Yeah, Dylan. You know, we met Dylan, like, in 62, and his manager said, "Won't you meet the Staples singers?" He said, "Oh, I know the Staples singers. I've listened to the Staples singers since I was 12 years old." But he even quoted a lyric out of one of ours. He said, "Mavis be singing, yonder come little David with his rockin' sling. I don't want to meet him. He's a dangerous man." And it just blew Pops' mind. But then he started singing his song, and Pops said, "Listen, y'all, you hear what that kid is saying?" And he was saying, "How many roads must a man walk down before you can call him a man?" And that Pops could relate to that. So he said, "We can sing that song." And we did.
I bet you did.
Yeah, we came right home and learned it.
Yeah, but I got to ask, you actually and Dylan became quite close, right?
Oh, you know.
Uh-oh.
Oh, Dylan. Yeah, Dylan was,
All right. That's fine, man.
We were good friends.
We were good friends.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed.
Bob, you know, he was a cutie back then. He was.
He really was. Curly. He had that curly hair.
Didn't he? Eh?
Yeah.
He had curly hair.
He was tiny.
But Mavis,
though.
I'm sorry, you could sing him under the table.
Oh, come on. But his lyrics are, you know, he's the world's greatest poet. But no, I can't sing Dylan under the table, you know, just because he's tiny. But back then, both of us were little, you know.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And
you're appropriately scaled. I understand.
I
understand.
I don't know how that got out. Someone, that internet.
Yeah. You know.
that doggone internet, you know. One disc jockey said, well, I hear you and Dylan, you know, proposed marriage to you. I said, where did you get that from? The internet.
Well, then it must be true.
It's got to be true.
Well?
Yes, indeed.
And what was your response to this question?
That, well, you know, I cannot tell a lie. I'm Pop Staples' daughter. But I didn't acknowledge it. You know, I just said, after he told me where, I said, those internet people just need to mind their own business.
Yeah.
You know, but Dylan, the way he did that, he just did it out of the blue. He proposed.
He proposed out of the blue.
What he told Pops. He didn't tell me.
What, Bob Dylan asked your father for your hand in marriage?
He didn't ask. He told Pops.
He told him.
Pops,
he's a lot braver than I thought he was.
Yeah.
What did he say to your father?
Pops, I want to marry Mavis. And Pop said, well, don't tell me, tell Mavis.
You little pisha.
That was during the time, it was lunch. Everybody heard him. We were in line, you know, to get our lunch.
Wait a minute. You're standing in line?
Yeah.
At like some sort of buffet?
That's right.
And he's standing there behind your father and says, oh, by the way.
Yeah.
I want to marry your daughter, and can I have the potatoes? What?
He just shouted it. I guess it just came over him.
I understand.
Something came. Something got a hold of
him. I feel it now. I'm totally down with that. I want to talk about somebody else who, at least we know, is a fan of yours because he used your song at his campaign rallies, Mr. Barack Obama.
Obama, mama.
Yeah. You must be.
Yeah.
That's a sign. They were playing. I'll take you there, right?
I'll take you there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard it many times in his campaigns.
Did they reach out to you at all? Have you met the man?
Not at all.
You're
kidding
me. You
know, we belong to the same church.
Yeah.
And Barack.
Obama. I make the same mistake.
You did that. Barack. When he was at church, we weren't there.
Right.
When we were in church, he wasn't there.
Yeah.
So we never had the opportunity to meet him.
Right.
But I was very happy for him. I was very happy that he is the president-elect. That night, I didn't make it to Grant Park. I was at home. I was just filled with joy. I tried to do a cartwheel.
How'd that go?
I couldn't get up there.
I understand.
I couldn't get up.
I understand. But we don't understand this. We understand that for the inauguration, the Obama people have picked some other singer, this Aretha something.
Wow.
She's not from Chicago.
Oh, what's her name?
Yeah. I don't understand what's up with that.
Riri. It's good. It's all good. You know.
Well, you're a very gracious person. But I'm just saying, because I know, I'm sure Barack Obama drops everything to listen to this show. I'm just saying, Chicago born, Chicago, you know, this is you got to represent Hyde Park, Mr.
President. I really should be there.
I think
she really
should
be there.
I think she should be there. It was your song that put him over the top, so,
yes,
you know,
yes.
I'm just saying.
Yes, I should be there. You know, I've been to Kennedy's inauguration, Carter, and Clinton. Why am I not at Barack Obama?
I don't know. I think something should be done about this.
Yeah, Peter,
yes.
fix it for me.
I will. You have no idea what sway I have.
I can.
I am a public radio host.
I know that's right. I know that's
when I
right.
say
right,
jump.
You could give Barack Obama like a mug or something.
Oh yes, yes.
In exchange,
we could swap commemorative plates.
Right.
And does he do anything for that? Well, Mavis Staples, we are so delighted to have you with us. We have asked you here to play a game we're calling.
Hello, I'm looking for a dozen highlighter pens and a fluorescent green.
Which is a question we're sure you get all the time by the people who confuse you with Staples, the office supply superstore.
Oh.
But since you are not a vast warehouse filled with office implements, we thought we'd ask you three questions about office supplies.
Oh.
If you get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners. Carl's voice on their home answering machine. Carl, who is Mavis Staples playing for?
Mavis is playing for Henry Herman of Falls Church, Virginia.
Are you ready to do this?
I'm ready.
You can do this. You can handle any challenge. I can tell. We begin with the stapler. This office device was invented, strange as it may seem, by whom? A, President Millard Fillmore, who frittered away his time in office trying to improve the efficiency of White House filing. B, King Louis XV of France, who desired a way to affix gold metal seals to his documents. Or C, Isaac Newton, the great physicist, who tried to market it as a toy.
Ah.
Millard Fillmore, Louis XV, Isaac Newton. One of them invented the stapler.
I think I'll go with Brother Fillmore. Did he do it?
I'm sorry, it was actually Louis XV of France invented the stapler. I know, I'm sorry about that. He did want to put his little gold seals on his little documents. All right, we still have two more chances here.
Okay.
Next office product, Scotch tape.
Oh, wow.
How did it get its name, Mavis? How did Scotch tape get its name? A, it was named after the sound it makes when you tear off a long strip, like scourge. B, it was first marketed during the great Scottish fad of the 1920s when all the products were being sold in tartan with kilts and shillelaghs. Or C, it was a rude ethnic joke aimed at the owners of the company who were too Scottish and thus cheap to put more glue on the tape.
Ah. You know, that one you said they were wearing the kilts. Let's go with him.
You're going to go with that. You're going to go with that. It was just a big Scotch thing. Everything,
yeah,
everything cool.
Yeah.
Like instead of like I in front of everything, everything was Scots or man.
Scotch.
It was actually it was an ethnic joke. I'm sorry. It was. Oh, I never felt
Peter.
Worse. I feel terrible.
Peter.
Don't make it worse.
Why you treat me so bad? I tell you, I've been good.
No, actually, what happened with the Scotch tape, not that it's important, was that they were testing it and they gave it to the first people to use and they said, take this tape back to those Scotch bosses of yours and tell them to put more adhesive on it. And the name stuck and it became.
So that's not an ethnic joke?
That's very offensive, don't you think,
yeah,
Roy?
Yeah.
Scots Americans.
I don't even like to hear it repeated.
I know.
All right, last question.
Okay.
We bring you the adding machine. The first practical adding machine was invented by William Seward Burroughs in the 1880s, but it had a small flaw. What was it? A, if you added too many numbers too quickly, it would catch fire. B, the results you got depended on how hard you pulled the handle. Or C, if you wanted to subtract numbers, you had to disassemble the machine, a process that took 2 hours every time.
I like that.
You going to go with that, the disassembling? Like
that. Yeah, disassemble it, you know, and let's hang loose with it. it take 2 hours.
To disassemble it, in case you wanted to take a number.
And what was this about?
This is. It was about nothing of any importance whatsoever.
Oh, Peter.
No, it was about adding machines. You know,
did I win
thing.
Anything for
well,
him?
Well, hold on.
Oh, yeah, the
well, I should mention just in passing that, in fact, the right answer was B. But that's not important right now. Did you know that the guy who invented the adding machine, his grandson was William Burroughs? Yeah, William Burroughs, yeah. The writer.
Ah.
Who knew that?
Wow.
I didn't know that. Did you know that?
Well, that,
I didn't know.
That
I
makes
know
it all better, Peter.
It does, yeah.
Good.
Carl, how did Mavis Staples do in our quiz?
Not too well, Peter. She needed at least two correct answers to win for Henry Herman.
Yeah. Oh, Henry.
Yeah.
Henry. Oh, Henry.
Oh, Henry.
I think he just made his day.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah,
I'm
like,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Say his name in that voice of yours, and I think he'll feel fine.
He'll put that on his answer machine.
Yeah. Oh, Henry.
Hey! All right. I would much rather just talk to you than do anything else, so I'm going to ask you a couple more questions. Now, you've got a new CD out. It's called Live Hope at the Hideout, right? Hideout here in Chicago. Great little club.
Yeah.
Yes.
You're not going to stop performing, are you?
Oh, no way.
No way.
No way.
No way. Bless your heart for that.
No way.
Mavis Staples is a Hall of Fame singer.
Thank you.
Her latest album, Live Hope at the Hideout, available now. Mavis Staples, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Mavis.
I know a place. Ain't nobody crying.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, guys. This week, we are, of course, reliving some of our favorite visits with impressive women. Now, I was 12 years old when Star Wars first came out, so you know what that means. I used to dress up in white robes and do my hair up like Danishes on the side of my head. I got the chance to talk to my idol, Carrie Fisher, about her memoir in early 2009. The cover of the book is a picture of Princess Leia, her head on a table holding an empty martini glass, okay?
And I think pills floating around, if
pills
I'm not
are
mistaken.
Floating around. So this is the kind of book it is. It's sort of brutally honest. You describe in the book your childhood, your parents, Debbie Reynolds, Eddie Fisher,
You say they were sort of like the Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston of their day.
That's right, and Elizabeth Taylor was Angelina Jolie.
Right. Oh, the vixen. So when you were a baby, you were famous. You were like on all the tabloids, all the gossip. There's Debbie Reynolds smiling at her new baby girl, Carrie.
Well, yeah, they took pictures of me, I think, starting when I was 3 hours old. So if it's true what the Africans say, that you lose your soul when you get photographed,
yeah.
I'm a totally soulless human being.
There you are.
There's this, Carrie, in your book, there's this amazing chart you have that puts together all the people who are in your family. When you looked at that chart, could you believe that was your life? I mean, it's your mom and your dad and Elizabeth
yes.
Taylor. And, oh, my gosh.
Yes, I could believe it. I did it because my daughter had was flirting with Elizabeth Taylor's grandson. So
oh,
they
Jesus.
Asked me if they were related. And that was why I did the chart, which ultimately they're related by scandal.
I see. Now, I want to ask, you tell a story and it kind of sums up how odd your life was in the way that your parents tried to intervene or get somebody to intervene with you when you had some problems with drugs later on, or early on, I should say.
My mother, yes, called Cary Grant, like any normal mother would do, to talk to me about not doing LSD.
And
because
what,
yeah. he actually had, it was known at the time, that he'd gone to a doctor and done LSD under doctor's supervision.
Right.
But anyway, he did call, and we chatted about me not doing acid. And then my father ran into him at Princess Grace's funeral, and he went up and said to him, "My daughter's addicted to acid." So two times Cary Grant called to convince me
the second
not
time,
to do acid.
The second time that he called, did he say, "It's me again"?
That's right.
I want to dork out on you for a little bit. This is a total dork question, but it's bothered me for years. You're doing the first movie. You are, of course, of the great romantic interest of the young hero Luke Skywalker.
Mm-hmm.
We found out later, quite famously, that your sisters, or sister and brother, rather, did you know that when you did the first movie?
Not at all.
So you didn't know that you were supposed to be Lucas? He
no,
didn't tell you.
No, I didn't know, and he also didn't tell me about the metal bikini. I was brought to San Francisco and shown this thing I was going to have to wear.
Mm. Isn't a metal bikini sort of cold?
Well, what it is it doesn't adhere to your body. So Boba Fett
that would
was
be the
standing behind me. You
yeah,
remember
yeah.
him?
I remember him well, yes.
And I'm laying there on Jabba the Hutt, and he can see all the way to Florida.
And he's wearing that mask, so who knows where he's looking. So he's having a good time.
Yep, there's nothing I can do about
got
it.
Got to ask you about the hair. You had that hair, the famous hair.
I hated that hair.
Yeah, and did you? Could you do anything about it? Did you try to do anything about it?
No, I didn't understand why they'd hired me to begin with. So I.
That's because you hadn't worn the bikini yet.
I didn't want to make any trouble, so that whatever they told me to do, that was just fine. And they put the horrible hairstyle on. They'd given me the job with the caveat that I had to lose 10 pounds. And I weighed 105 at the time. Mm.
Good grief.
But the about 60 of those pounds were in my face. So a good idea would be, though, to give me a hairstyle that further widens my already wide face.
Right.
And it took 2 hours to do that hairstyle. When I did Saturday Night Live, they had one just made up. It just plopped on your head, and I thought, why couldn't we have done that?
Well, Carrie Fisher, we are honored to have you with us. We have invited you here to play a game we're calling...
Okay, it's complicated and expensive, and it never worked, but at least this Star Wars doesn't have Ewoks.
Oh, fantastic.
That's right, Carrie Fisher. We're going to ask you about the other Star Wars, formerly known as the Strategic Defense Initiative, the Missile Defense Program, dreamed up by Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. Get
right.
three questions about this Star Wars right. You'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice, on their home answering machine. Carl, who is Carrie Fisher playing for?
She is playing for Katrina Herlihy of Chicago.
All right, here we go. Here's your first question. People have wondered for years why Reagan became so enamored with the idea of shooting down enemy missiles with ray guns.
Among the possible reasons were which of these? A, he once played a spy named Brass Bancroft in a movie serial whose mission was to protect a new government space weapon called the Inertia Ray. Was it B, he liked to pun on his name, saying things like, I'm a real ray gun, and if you don't watch out, I'll blast you. Or C, he loved to collect umbrellas, always looking for the sturdiest and strongest, and wondered how big and effective they could get.
I'm going to have to say A, though I wish I could say B.
You're going to say A, that he played a guy named Brass Bancroft in movie serial involving a ray gun.
Just as probable as the umbrellas.
You're right. But you're right. He did play Brass Bancroft in a movie serial in which there was an inertia ray shot down enemy planes. All right. That's good. You have two more questions. Here's number two. Reagan was encouraged to pursue Star Wars by the notorious Dr. Edward Teller, known as the father of the hydrogen bomb. Teller told the president that the U.S. could construct powerful X-ray lasers that could shoot down enemy missiles. But Teller didn't tell the president one small detail. What? A, each X-ray laser would have to be a mile long and cost $1 trillion. B, each X-ray would have to be powered by an exploding atomic bomb. Or C, at the current rate of research and development, the X-ray lasers would be ready to launch in 2150.
I like A, but I'm going to go with C.
You're going to go with C, that they wouldn't be ready till 2150?
Yeah.
No, it was B. The lasers would work beautifully as long as you could blow up an atomic bomb every time you needed to use one to provide the X-rays.
Oh, damn.
Teller neglected to mention that detail. The program went forward. All right. Third question. The SDI program never became operational despite a few successful tests. At least one of those tests back in the 80s might not have been as successful as the Pentagon claimed. Why? A, the Pentagon said it was a success when one of its target missiles happened to blow up by accident. B, the target missiles were wired to explode when the Star Wars missile got anywhere near it. Or C, the Pentagon claimed that the Hunter missile found its target simply because both missiles crashed into the same ocean.
Let me go with three, then.
You're going to go with the third choice, that they both crashed into the Pacific. No, I'm afraid it was B. It was B, yes. They were wired to explode, you see. And thus
see,
the Pentagon.
I'm not good at this.
No, it's all right.
Yes.
So, Carl, how did Carrie Fisher do in our quiz?
Well, Carrie needed at least two correct answers to win for Katharina Herlihy, but she had just one.
Wow.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
It's all right, because even though you didn't do well on this, you still helped blow up two Death Stars.
That's really what counts.
Isn't it, though, ultimately?
Yeah.
Carrie Fisher is an actress and the author of several books. Her latest book, Wishful Drinking, has been in the New York Times bestseller list for 7 weeks and counting. Carrie Fisher, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, guys.
Bye-bye.
Nice talking to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Finally, a real diva. Federica von Stada is the greatest American mezzo-soprano of her generation.
When we spoke to her in front of a packed house at Zellerbach Hall in Berkeley, California, she seemed amazingly, even frustratingly, nice.
It turns out that panelist Mo Rocca was a fan, but not exactly of her opera singing.
Oh, can I tell you what aria of yours I love the most? Many of them, of what you've performed, I love. I love the, and I don't know how you say it in Italian, but the Star Trek aria.
Oh.
What is this now?
I did the Star Trek aria on the Emmys once. You know, the, I was doing it, and very quite seriously. You know, I take it my work seriously.
So do I.
And it was, this is clear. And I was going, and behind, and people were laughing hysterically, and I thought, but it's not funny.
No, I agree.
And they were showing videos behind me. They were not thinking of me.
They weren't.
But you have to know that Star Trek is very, very important to Peter.
Yes.
Like, I've not been to his home, but my guess would be the bed set.
Yes. And the jammies.
Yeah, all the jammies. And the doors all go whoosh and slide into the walls.
Yes.
Talk to me about, like, the cliches or stereotypes of opera. For example, the whole diva idea. The diva originally is, of course, the opera diva. You, basically, the lead female singer.
When I first started singing, there really was the diva world. And I sang at the Metropolitan Opera, and Renata Tebaldi would come in, and Joan Sutherland, and they'd all be dressed head to toe in furs and jewels, and they all, everybody had a dog. But I think I sort of miss it. It was fun. And when you hear all the stories about Maria Callas.
Yeah. For those of you just listening, she's dressed in furs.
But we do appreciate how quiet
and
her
jewels.
Dog has been. Yeah.
Jewels, well, yeah.
But did you ever get to do that in your early years? Did you ever get to go full on diva?
No, not really. I've done it on stage, and it is fun.
You play
it's
the role
fun. Stage. It's dress up. You know, a lot of opera is playing dress up in the most
marvelous
way.
But it's not just the way they dress. Wasn't it the attitude of them as well? Didn't they like receive fruit plates and then the dressing room door would fly open and the fruit plate would come out?
And it was fun when that happened, and then it got more sane.
Fun for whom?
Fun to watch for all of us.
Did you ever throw a fruit plate?
No, I never threw a fruit plate.
Really?
I would go in my dressing room and
cry. I mean,
she was a passive aggressive diva. People wanted her to throw the fruit plate so she wouldn't do it.
Yeah. I wanted the fruit.
More important to you than the gesture. But honestly, there are few periods or places in life where you have a basically carte blanche to behave as badly as you want.
Yeah.
And singing the lead in a major opera has got to be one of them.
Oh, it is. And now you can't kind of get away with it as much anymore.
Really?
It's really... I mean, there are marvelous stories about Callas that when she left a great performance at La Scala, her fans would pick up her car and carry it to her home. Pick up the car.
When she'd get in the car, the fans would pick it up.
Pick it up, and that's how incredible it was. I mean, that's...
What kind of car?
Exactly.
So it's not like the NPR fans.
Yeah.
When we leave here, it's like...
Well, look at them all.
I mean, they'll tear the clothes right off my back.
Do you guys want me to tell you which car is mine so you can hoist it?
Now, a lot of opera fans, as you of course know, tend to be older. Are you ever afraid that the audience is, aging out and dying off?
Yeah, we are.
It's like the Elks and the Moose Clubs are dealing with the same thing.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Frederica von Stade, we are so delighted to have you with us.
Thank
We've invited you here to play a game that we're calling...
Hello, beautiful. I'm burning up because I have a crazy kind of crush on you.
As I'm sure you realize, that means we are going to ask you three questions about the Jonas Brothers. The hottest, coolest boy band since the last one. If you get two out of three questions right about Kevin, Joe... And Nick, yes, the third Jonas Brother.
Yeah, that's right,
the
Nick.
Cute one, right? Nick is the cute one, yes? You'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice on that listener's home answering machine, screaming like a 13-year-old girl.
It's the Johannes Brothers.
Carl, who is Frederica von Stade playing for?
Peter, she is playing for John Jerome of Trinidad, California.
There you go. All right, ready to go?
Yes, I am.
First question. Jonas Brothers concerts are known for their multimedia appeal. In fact, the throngs of female fans are often sent into paroxysms of joy when they get to see what projected onto the big jumbotron. A, Kevin as a baby nursing. B, Nick replacing his insulin pump. Or C, all three boys in the bathroom brushing their teeth in unison.
C.
You can go for C, brushing their teeth. Mm-hmm. No, it's actually replacing the insulin pump.
Oi!
Nick is very public about his diabetes, but the girls, it seems, aren't applauding his courage, but the fact they get a little glimpse of his bare torso.
Wait, who is replacing the pump for?
He's doing it himself.
He's
monitoring his own insulin pump.
He doesn't have fangirls doing it for him?
I'm sure many would volunteer.
Okay.
All right, you still have two more chances here. Next question. The Jonas Brothers are expanding their empire into new media, including, of course, a TV show, Jonas, it's going to be called. It's about three brothers trying to be rock stars while living a normal life. That was not the original concept of the TV series, though. What was? Was it A, that Jonas would stand for Junior Operative Networking as Spies, and the boys would be international spies pretending to be teenage rock stars? Was it B, one of the brothers, Nick, would actually be an android built by the other two who did not feel that they were cute enough on their own?
Or C, in addition to their singing skills, each brother would have a superpower. Which of these was the original concept for the upcoming Jonas Brothers TV show?
C.
C, superpower.
Superpower.
Oh, no.
Mo doesn't think you should go with that.
Change your answer.
A.
You're going to go for A?
Yeah.
Mo taught you in A?
Yeah.
Wise person to listen to Mo. He's right.
What was it?
Junior operative networking as spies. That was the original concept. Someone at the Disney Channel realized this would be gilding that lily, if you will. All right, you've got one out of two right with one to go. Here is your final question. They've got one hit movie already, Camp Rock. They're making a sequel to that movie, but they've already optioned a well-known book so that they can star in the film adaptation. What is the book? Is it A, The Dirt, the autobiography of the band Motley Crue? B, Undaunted Courage, the story of Lewis and Clark?
So the third one has to be Sacagawea.
Or is it C, Walter the Farting Dog?
Oh no, oh gosh.
There's been a lot of that.
This is tough.
It is hard. It's,
C.
C, yes, you're right, C.
You're amazing.
You are.
Yeah, but she was.
And it's still the second act.
Well done. You got it, right? It was C. It's going to be Walter the Farting Dog. The movie will be directed naturally by the Farrelly brothers.
Consider it an opera buffo.
So, Carl, how did Frederica Von Stade do in our quiz?
Frederica had two correct answers, Peter, so she wins for John Jerome.
Well done. Frederica Von Stade is a world-renowned star of the opera. She's America's favorite mezzo-soprano. In 2010, she will begin her farewell tour. In addition, she's currently working with the Young Musicians Program right here at Cal Berkeley. Frederica Von Stade, thank you so much for being with us. You were great. Brava.
Support for NPR comes from CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight, 436 miles, on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. Lumber Liquidators, whose flooring includes pre-finished and stained solid hardwoods, bamboo, cork, and laminates. Information at lumberliquidators.com. And the National Association of Realtors, whose members recognize that every market is different. A realtor is a member of the National Association of Realtors. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and Chicago Public Radio in association with Urgent Haircut Productions. Doug Berman, executive producer. BJ Lederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Emily Ecton. Ian Chillog and Eva Walchover, our technical directors are Robert Newhouse and Lorna White. The senior producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mike Danforth. Carl Castle, thank you so much. Thanks to all of our panelists, all our fabulous guests. Thanks to you all for listening. I am Peter Sagal. We will see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.